Young and Braun vote against Justice Jackson. Holcomb versus the legislature at the Supreme Court, plus hospitals and insurers casting blame, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending April 8th, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, the U.S. Senate, in a bipartisan vote, confirmed Ketanji Brown Jackson as the next Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. When she takes on the job later this year, she will become the first black woman in history to do so. Both of Indiana's senators voted against her. In a statement, Republican Senator Todd Young said after meeting with Jackson and reviewing her record as a judge, he believes she will legislate from the bench, which he says he opposes. Senator Mike Braun said much the same. After meeting with Jackson, Braun said he would vote against her again after previously voting against her for a federal appellate court because he thinks she's a judicial activist. Indiana Democratic Party Chair Mike Schmuel said Young and Braun let partisanship come before American history. Does an individual nominee matter anymore when it comes to Supreme Court confirmations? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Anne Delaney. Republican, Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Lindsay Erdody, WFYI digital editor for Health and Education. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, Jackson was nominated by a Democrat. Is that really the only thing that mattered to Todd Young and Mike Braun?
I think it's the only thing that matters in Washington, D.C. You know, anymore, we kind of back our way into these, kind of start with the position and then figure out why. You know, at least Senator Braun was consistent in his vote. He cast the same vote for the same reasons that
unlike some of his Republican colleagues.
You know, Todd Young did not, he would break with Trump. He would break with the party when Trump was still in office, and always had a good explanation for why he'd do it. And was thoughtful about it. And so I always, you know, trust that he takes a thoughtful approach to, you know, these types of decisions. I appreciate it. One, we had, you know, we're kind of gaining on it. We had three Republicans vote for Jackson, but, you know, it was just three more than Democrats threw at Trump's nominees. So maybe we're gaining on it. I did appreciate Lisa Murkowski's perspective that part of her reason for her yes vote was to make this look like this process represents anything in reality. Like go back to anything that of how this actually ought to operate, and that's on a bipartisan basis. We have completely destroyed this kind of pillar from an institutional standpoint. The process of nominating and approving, God forbid, you have a Republican in the White House and a Democratic Senate or vice versa, yeah. Right? I mean,
that's exactly what I wanted to ask you. Increasingly, is it going to become you have to have both the Senate and the presidency to get judges or justices?
Or to get anything done, frankly, okay? You know, it's really disappointing. I mean, I didn't expect anything better from Senator Braun, but I did expect better from Senator Young, and I was very disappointed. He holds up Richard Lugar as his role model and his mentor, and Richard Lugar would be rolling over in his grave at this move. Because Richard Lugar approved of any nominee that he thought was qualified, regardless of whether it was a Democratic appointment or not. And this shows that all Todd Young was interested in doing is catering to the right wing of his party. And it didn't matter that this was an eminently qualified person. It didn't matter that these two senators are the first senators in the history of Indiana to vote against both a woman and an African American. And what does that say about them? She's eminently qualified, a two-time Harvard graduate, and he could not even bring himself to do the right thing in the tradition of Richard Lugar, and that's disappointing.
The model that Ann just talked about, that as long as you're qualified, I will vote for you, is that just gone at this point, John?
It seems to be gone, and that's unfortunate because that's not the way Washington operated for hundreds of years. And Dick Lugar is a perfect example of that. I mean, he was on record as saying precisely what Ann just talked about, that I look at the credentials. You know, and politics to him was not an emotional thing. It was an intellectual endeavor. And you're looking at things where people got their schooling and what, you know, were all the T's crossed and I's dotted in terms of the resume. And so he did vote for Elena Kagan for the Supreme Court. He did vote for Sonia Sotomayor. But it went beyond just the Supreme Court. He voted for Jocelyn Elders when she was a nominee, a Clinton nominee for Surgeon General. And that was very controversial because she wanted to do things such as, you know, have condom distribution in schools, heaven forbid. But he was true to form, whether it was an ambassador, whether it was a judicial. Yeah, and I think that is kind of the notion that I don't want to get in the founders' heads, but I think the notion of going to the Senate to confirm nominees was basically another review, another check, if you will, not let's start from scratch and see you know, the politics of this. Because somebody won at the ballot box, the president won. Sometimes it's a Republican, sometimes it's a Democrat. And that comes with some perks and privileges, such as getting appointments of your ilk.
To that point, I'll go back, Lindsay, I'll go back to the very first question I asked, which was, does an individual nominee matter anymore? Does it only matter who nominated them?
At this point, yes, I think so. I mean, I think Mike is pretty optimistic that maybe we're getting a little bit better because we had a couple, you know, Republicans vote for her. But you have
a few, yes.
Not a couple. More than a couple.
But you've had that a little bit throughout, like, the past few nominees that we've had. We've talked a lot about Lugar voting for Obama's appointees. And former Senator Joe Donnelly voted for one of Trump's nominations. So, you know, you've had it here and there, but you have to go back, like, to the Clinton era to see more widespread bipartisan support. And I think it's just going to keep getting worse and worse as we go on in terms of the partisanship. And, you know, like you were saying earlier, having to have the White House and the Senate to really get anything done, and especially having a Supreme Court nomination.
Well, Republicans almost did. It's worth remembering that had we not spent the months after the election talking about the fact that the election was a total fraud, we would have won two special elections in Georgia in January, and we probably would have controlled the Senate and this process, which could have forced Joe Biden to nominate. If you believe that this was an extreme nomination, that reality, that political reality, may have forced President Biden to nominate a moderate. So
somebody like the Wall Street Journal. Moderate like Merrick Garland.
Wait, she is a moderate. Yeah, exactly.
I was gonna say,
this has nothing to do with liberalism. It has nothing to do with, activism, yeah. Because the people that the Republicans have put on the Supreme Court are the most activist judicious.
I just thought it was interesting. There are parts of the party right now that are pointing fingers at each other saying, hey, if we were focused on winning Georgia instead of yes.
Well, good.
Read the Wall Street Journal today. It's all they did.
The partisanship goes beyond just how one votes on the actual nominee when it comes up for a vote. It also has to do with whether there will be consideration of a nominee at all. Because now we have the rules that Mitch McConnell had imposed before. Well, if it's within X months of the election, you know, this is too close to have somebody. So, you know, if we have another opening at this point, I presume we might be in that window of that sort of no man's land.
Maybe Clarence Thomas will do the right thing and resign.
Yeah, it might be until the clock runs.
You know, yeah. No, I don't think so. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, would Senator Todd Young and Senator Mike Braun have voted for anyone President Joe Biden nominated for the Supreme Court? Young might have, Braun might have, both might have, or neither would have. Last week's question, who came out the winner in Abdul Hakim Shabazz's lawsuit against Attorney General Todd Rokita over press access? 69% of you say Abdul, just 7% say Todd Rokita. Apparently Todd was voting a lot. 4% say both, and 20% say neither. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the Indiana legislature's power to act during a public emergency when it's not in session is at stake in a lawsuit heard before the state Supreme Court Thursday. The core issue is whether the Indiana Constitution gives the governor sole authority to call a special session of the legislature. But much of the discussion Thursday centered on whether the governor should be allowed to sue in this case. Early on, Justice Jeffrey Slaughter noted that the law in question, HEA 1123, doesn't stop the governor from using his power to call a special session.
There's nothing about 1123 that prevents him from doing that right away. So how is he impaired? How is he harmed?
Yet later on, Slaughter questioned the attorney representing lawmakers about his position that the governor is barred from suing the legislature, which Slaughter called astonishing.
So you're saying that Eric Holcomb as governor can't bring the suit, but Eric Holcomb as private citizen might well?
And that encapsulates why it's hard to predict the outcome of the case merely from the justices' questions. There's no timetable for their ruling. And Delaney, should we be worried that the core question won't be answered by the Supreme Court?
No, I think the Supreme Court will answer the core question because it's an important question. And, you know, the arguments that Todd Rokita, through his mouthpiece, the Fisher, has made are they're not only irrelevant, it is amazing to me that this is the biggest argument, I think, for abolishing the office of electing the Attorney General. How does he decide who he represents in this? And he decides he represents the case that he thinks is going to appeal to his right-wing groups, as opposed to does he represent the governor or does he represent the legislature? The point is you can't make a decision like this, which is why the governor has to be able to have his own counsel, has to be able to get a declaratory judgment. I mean, the argument that you could, that he as an individual could bring a declaratory judgment action, but he couldn't bring it in his role as governor, it's laughable. And on top of that, I was really...
Well, astonishing is just astonishing.
Astonishing, yeah. It is... The idea that he's not harmed because he can still call a special session ignores the history. When you have an issue of whether there's a special session, the governor has power to negotiate as to what's going to be discussed and how long it's going to go and what isn't going to be on the topics. You take that out of the way if the legislature flaunts the Constitution by calling the special session on its own. And the other problem with this is I watched Todd Fisher's argument, and I was shocked at how disrespectful he was to the Supreme Court and how he just tossed aside any questions that he had as not being important or not being relevant. I can't imagine a Solicitor General doing that to the highest court in the state, and I was offended.
Anne pointed out a couple of different issues here, and there are multiple important issues. One, whether the legislature can come in and pass laws during a public emergency on their own as opposed to having the governor call them in. That matters to how a state reacts during a public emergency. There's also this question of whether the attorney general absolutely has to give the okay for the governor to sue the legislature or the governor to sue in general. With all of those competing interests, though, is there a real chance that Hoosiers aren't going to get a lot of clarity out of this process?
Well, I think we've gone well beyond, just the conversation about this has gone right here and everywhere. It's gone well beyond why we're here to begin with, which is the legislature wanted to have a say in the emergency powers that fairly, in their defense, were never passed contemplating that they'd be in place for a long period of time. It floods, tornadoes, public health emergency, in a narrow sense,
right.
You know, a Scott County HIV outbreak, right? I mean, like, narrow things that required...
Terrorist attacks. That's that.
Some
I mean, in
exceptional
the wake of
powers
9/11.
On a temporary basis.
Yeah.
It never contemplated that it'd be in place for 2 years. So fair enough, legislature, that you thought you ought to... You didn't want to. They jumped up and down about it.
But they also could have changed his emergency powers.
Yes.
And chose
they could have done
to.
That. And so to the question of standing or harm... You are setting up a scenario where the governor retains a special session. What if the legislature says, we don't want that special session, we want this one over here where we can do all these things. You want it to be this, we want to do all these things, we want to be in all year all
you
year
want
to do it.
We want to be a full-time legislature.
We've already, in the debate over this last year, we have more than breached that full-time legislature conversation and expectation that if they don't like something, they can come in the next day and try to do something different, which they tried to do in November and couldn't get consensus on what to do to eliminate the emergency order. So it wound up never taking place. We created another special session in statute for redistricting, right, to accommodate very real delays in census.
Well, they just never adjourned, too.
Right, and so that it does feel, you know, I'm in the building every day, it did feel like we were never not in session going back to November of 2020.
An interesting wrinkle to me in yesterday's argument was this brought up the question of, you know, part of the legislature's argument here is that, well, we've been basically calling ourselves into session for decades with what's known as the technical session, which is what they do. They say, before their session ends, they say, okay, on this date, we're going to come in case we need to fix any grievous errors in the bills we passed or override any gubernatorial vetoes. They're set to come back on May 24th to do just that. Is there a chance that could get struck down by the Supreme Court?
I am fascinated to see how this ruling impacts that, and thought it was so interesting that that came up in this debate. Because you're right, they have adjourned sine die. They are done. Right. And yet they come back in for this day. It's not org day. It's not starting a new session. It's just this day on its own where they're there. And a lot of times they're not doing things of substance, right? But we already know this year that they're going to come in and consider a veto override of the transgender youth sports bill. That's pretty substantive, right?
It was hotly political in the Republican primary and then hotly political in the convention.
Yeah.
2 weeks later. I mean, it's playing out.
Yes.
Yeah, so, That's why.
Exactly. So, you know, I don't know if this is one of those unintended consequences of this lawsuit.
God, I hope so.
Do away with the technical session.
But yeah. I given the questions that were asked about that, I think there will be some implications for technical correction
so too.
Yeah.
John, I'm going to get a little ahead of ourselves right now, which is let's say that the legislature doesn't win this case. Let's say they don't get to have this emergency session that they've tried to create. I'm going to leave the technical session part out of it for a moment. What does that do to, you know, do they go back and now do they say to Governor Holcomb, well, fine, we couldn't do that. Well, we're going to take away some of your emergency powers. Or do they just try to amend the Constitution, which is, as several justices suggested, the most logical path here?
That certainly would be the most logical path. That would be neat, clean. You know, voters have a say. We always say we want voters to have a say because our process for amending the Constitution is it's passed, of course, by the General Assembly, and then it twice, two successive sessions, and then, of course, goes to voters. And that's what other states have done. It came out in testimony that there were 11 states basically had given General Assemblies this power initially. And then over the years, for whatever reason, more have done so. I think it's up to 35, 36, but they've generally all gone the constitutional amendment route, which... Good. It does take more time, but that's what you want when you're changing
the Constitution.
Yeah. So they probably try to nibble away at it, but keep in mind that the hysteria that surrounded COVID and the notion of Big Brother telling people to wear masks or to do this and to do that and all the conspiracy theories and was it fake and maybe that's gone. And maybe there will be a desire to move on to other issues, which I think we'd all be pleased to see that happen. Because if you look at this, and
the likelihood of this law, if it is upheld, being used anytime soon,
right? And
seems
it's
pretty remote.
I mean, I was surprised by the amount of attention given to standing, whether there should be a declaratory judgment
just
or not.
Because, but Rokita's thrown up.
I understand
all these
that. I understand that. But I think you look
issues.
At history. You look at when we go back to when special sessions were created, when we went from a biennial session to essentially annual sessions back in the late 60s and into 70. The tradition's on the governor's side. History's on the governor's side. I would certainly.
And the Constitution.
A reading of the Constitution is on the
governor's
side. So I guess.
Not according to the trial court.
Well right.
Yeah.
And I'm not.
The trial court stands for election, too.
It does matter, but it's. I mean, no one really says what this is all about. I mean, when you listen to the oral argument, it's all about the legalities. No one actually just saying it's the Republican conservative governor has pissed off the more conservative members of his own party. And so they're going to get even using the attorney general as aiding and abetting them.
But you can't say that.
Yeah, but the justices presumably aren't looking at that.
And you can't put the attorney general over the governor, which is what they're trying to do. They're trying to say that he is more important than the governor.
And we can all agree that's
not
acceptable.
For now. Indiana's legislative leaders sent letters to the state's health care providers and insurers a few months ago. In it, they told them to act now to reduce health care costs, or lawmakers will take steps to do so next year. And some of the responses to those letters have become public this week. IU Health, the largest healthcare system in the state, made its reply public. In its letter to legislative leaders, it defended its existing plans to address high healthcare costs. That includes moving a goal to reach national average prices to January 2025, up from December 2025. IU Health also laid some blame at the feet of lawmakers. It says Indiana's poor citizen health is a contributing factor to high costs and notes in its letter that Indiana ranks 47th out of 50 in the country for public health spending. But the head of the Insurance Institute of Indiana says it's large hospitals that are to blame. Stop raking in record profits year after year, writes Marty Wood, representing Hoosier Insurance Companies, in a recent op-ed. It's likely that debate will continue into next session. John Schwanis, does this make you pessimistic about the potential for positive change?
Well, one must define positive change. I guess we all have different dogs in the fight. If benefit
positive
means
change
lower,
being lower, lower health care costs.
I don't see that necessarily happening. I don't think that the General Assembly, and I think that's why we, rather than seeing proposals with actual bills that would impose very rigid standards, we actually saw this sort of, hey, we're going to fire a shot across your bow. We're going to send you this letter, and we're going to see if you don't come up with a plan by April 1st, we might do something. So, and keep in mind, this is a Republican supermajority in the House and Senate. They're generally not wanting to get into things such as price controls and telling the private sector, even if it's the nonprofit, quasi-governmental sector, how to do that, do their business or set pricing. It's just not what they want to do. You also have this, the fact that this is a state where, because of Eli Lilly and Roche and other types of, we are a big medical state. We derive a lot of financial benefit as a state from our biotechnology and our pharmaceutical industry and our medical advances. We're not going to want to be the state, I don't think, that tries to put the kibosh on that and see people fleeing elsewhere. So I think it's probably, this is an issue that it will have to be addressed, but it will be addressed once again at the federal level. This is not going to be addressed at the state level.
Exactly to that point. So Todd Houston and Rod Bray sent this letter, and Todd Houston talked about this several times with us during the session, and he said, like, we don't want to, come down hard on them, but we will if they don't do anything. What realistically can state lawmakers do in this area?
That's a good question. And I mean, to the question before about, does this make you optimistic or pessimistic about what's going to happen? In 2020, they passed some legislation that really, at the end of the day, just boiled down to transparency of healthcare pricing. And, they said at the time that that was going to have an impact and it was going to lower healthcare costs. It was step one in that direction. But that being said, you have to know that, like, this website exists where you can look at the prices or this, and you have to be going to that. And as a consumer, you have to be shopping around and saying, I'm not going to go to IU Health, for example, because their prices are too high. I'm going to go over here and
which your insurance doesn't always allow you
right.
the freedom to do.
It may not be your doctor either.
Right.
Exactly. There are so many caveats to that. And plus, it's just having the time and will to do such a thing for that to really have any sort of an impact. And so you saw that happen in 2020. Then they send this letter and say, we're going to do something if you don't. But I think it's because they don't know how to pick the winners or losers in this and don't want to pick the winners and losers in this, because everyone is just pointing fingers at each other, the hospitals, the insurance companies, and then the hospitals are pointing back and saying, well, public health spending is bad. It's your fault.
So to that point where a lot of these, the responses, it seems, to this letter from the legislative leaders was, well, yeah, but what about them? Well, yeah, but what about them? Is that maybe where state lawmakers play a role in getting them to stop pointing fingers at each other and finding and pointing
them
at themselves?
I think that's where the governor might be able to do it, might be able to come in and say, look, you're right. We're at 47th in the country on spending on health care as a state, and we're going to do X and Y and Z, and we're going to try to get diabetes and obesity and smoking under control to have a better impact on all the costs that are associated with health care. In return, we want something from you and sit down and negotiate those things. Whether he'd have any power to enforce it is another question. But at least he could sit them down and say, if we do this, we'd like you to do this. But that's what it's going to take.
Governor Holcomb has been talking already about public health spending. He's got this this public health commission that he created. They've been studying things for several months now. They're going to continue the rest of this year. And Holcomb has been telegraphing for a while, I'm coming to the legislature during the budget writing session next year with a big old dollar amount that we're going to have to increase public health spending. I've been personally skeptical that lawmakers are prepared to go that direction, but does something like this conversation help the governor in that argument?
I think what has brought, one, I've worked in the State House and I've lobbied for providers. I started out with providers. I lobby for insurers now, and so I've been a part of this kind of bigger conversation, just to, in full disclosure. But what changed?
Sure.
So fingers
point. We can definitely point.
Why not? But in 20 years of doing this, one thing that has changed this conversation is that insurers have largely gotten out of the actual market of providing insurance, and employers are actually at risk for the amount of money that they're spending. And Obamacare kind of forced the market to move that direction. And now you've got employer. What created the kind of urgency in the last couple of years at the State House and really changed the dynamic was the employers finally came in and said, we can't do this anymore. Yeah. So something's got to change. And between drug companies, insurers, providers, individual people, the governor leading on public health, that's all part of the solution. But you know, employers and their employees are really what have changed the dynamic.
I wonder whether we could stop the advertising drugs on television too. You know, I mean, you get these advertising, you're in a tub
that's
outside.
One thing
I'm not involved in.
You could dance.
Finally,
quickly, a Southern Illinois County Treasurer, Ashley Gott, a man, will face off in a primary this year against a woman who just recently changed her name to Ashley Gott. Mike O'Brien, is that the most dedication to electoral strategy you've ever heard of?
I grew up in Cook County, Illinois. I love it.
I'm shocked this wasn't done in Chicago before. I mean, would you go that far to win an election?
No, but it's county treasurer. I mean, it's not like it's president. Yeah. It's county treasurer.
Well, it starts at the county treasurer.
So is she going to change her name?
Changing her name every single time, exactly. That is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Lindsay Erdody of WFYI. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.